You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme.
Privacy worked well in the past for François Hollande in 2007. The French only learned of the split between defeated socialist presidential candidate Ségolène Royal and her partner François Hollande after the electoral campaign.
From French sex scandals and controversial memoirs to Chinese news censorship, we'll review the day's top stories with George Brock and Brett Mason right here in the studio. Then we head to Milan, where Monocle's Tom Morris is poring over the latest designs and trends at Men's Fashion Week. We'll also review some modern art in Lisbon, get the latest news from our correspondent in Copenhagen, and play a bit of music for you too. All that coming up here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. Before all of that though, let's catch up on the world news. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Syria and Iran were high on the agenda as the French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius and the US Secretary of State John Kerry met in Paris today. Kerry said Syria's government and some rebels may be willing to permit humanitarian aid to flow, enforce local ceasefires and take other confidence-building measures in the nearly three-year-old civil war. Kerry said that he'd had a meeting with a representative of the Syrian opposition and he was confident that the country's opposition groups would attend peace talks in Switzerland later this month.
We had a very constructive meeting today. He's had very constructive comments to make about it, and I am confident that he and others will be in Geneva in order to pursue this negotiation. And with respect to the Assad regime, we have been told that from day one they allegedly are prepared to negotiate, and Foreign Minister Lavrov on several occasions has told me they're prepared to be there.
In Thailand, the protest leader Suthep Thaksaban has told thousands of supporters tonight that they would continue their campaign until they win or lose, placing no time limit upon the shutdown. Tens of thousands of Thai anti-government protesters occupied parks in central Bangkok, meeting no resistance from the authorities, ratcheting up a two-month agitation to force the resignation of the Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. More than 300,000 residents still have no safe drinking water. They've had this for 4 days in West Virginia because of a chemical spill back on Thursday. Major General James Hoyer of the West Virginia National Guard said there had been progress, but officials couldn't say when the ban might be lifted. As much as 5,000 gallons of industrial chemical leaked into the Elk River back on Thursday.
Over the past 24 hours, sampling and testing has provided confirmation that for a 24-hour period that we have at the water treatment facility a consistent number of below one part per million both at the outflow of the water treatment facility.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has signed a bill today that criminalises same-sex relationships, defying Western pressure over gay rights and provoking criticism from the United States. The US Vice President Joe Biden has just met with the Israeli President Shimon Peres today after both attended funeral services for the former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Biden and Peres discussed peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Sharon has now been buried at his family ranch in the Negev Desert beside his late wife Lily. Earlier, the Middle East peace envoy and the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair gave his eulogy.
The same iron determination he took to the field of war, he took to the chamber of diplomacy. But always his destination was clear, as was his motivation. He had the toughness of mind to despise all illusions about the threats facing Israel. He did not pursue peace as a dreamer, but he did dream of peace. And an end to war.
And finally, a growing cult of Hindu worshippers have been gathering today in India to drink, would you believe it, fresh cow urine, believing it will help prevent cancer. Hindus believe the cow to be a sacred animal, and they claim that the urine has divine healing properties. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Going off for your 6:05 brew now, will you be enjoying a...
It might perk me up, actually.
Give it a try. Tell us about it at 6:30.
It might be a bit acidic, actually.
Oh, dear. That's Jonathan Wheatley with the news for you here on Midori House. We'll be back with my special guests here in the studio just after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 6:18, 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is George Brock, Head of Journalism at City University London and the author of Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. I'm sure more about that later. Also here is Brett Mason, a Europe correspondent for SBS World News Australia. George, Brett, welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us. We'll start with some stories making the headlines out of the Middle East. First, the death of former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, which we've been covering extensively over the last couple of days, as Israel's political and military elite, along with various international dignitaries, though only from certain areas, not others, which perhaps we'll discuss, attended a state memorial ceremony in Jerusalem. It's always interesting, isn't it, when a sort of a figure who I guess the cliche would be to describe as a divisive figure when you look at recent political history, well, over several decades, passes on in this way. What are those particular challenges, you think, Brett, when you're sort of covering that story? Because it's important, isn't it, to reflect that sense that, you know, maybe not everyone was in accord about what their legacy will be.
And it's not a cliche, it's a reality. He was literally and physically a divisive figure in Middle East politics. And there are people who are very sad about his passing. And of course, there are people that are very happy that he's no longer here. No great surprise to see him pass away. He's been in a coma for 8 years, but still someone of that magnitude, when they pass away, there is that sense of shock and surprise. This is someone who we've watched over the last 20, 30 years really forge out modern Israel, the country that we've come to know, and some love, some despise. And that's a real challenge in journalism, because when you have such divisive figures, there are very different reactions to someone like that passing away. And we've seen that in the last 24 hours, people who have been celebrating and people who have been very upset about that.
And George, do you think that the balance generally is fairly good, certainly when we look at the sort of international press all around the world, at reflecting the kind of qualities that Brett's discussing?
I think the balance has been pretty reasonable. I think one of the things that really separates a first-class journalist from the rest is the ability, when you're reporting from another country and another culture, to actually allow your listeners or your viewers or your readers to think their way into the mind of the people who are in the situation you're describing. For example, nowadays, real military heroes who've done things, you know, who are still alive and have done real, are quite unusual in, for example, European societies. And one of the things about Sharon was that in 1973, he had done something, crossing the Suez Canal and the war of that time, which was so audacious and such a fantastic military coup, they still teach it in Israeli military staff colleges. I mean, it's a textbook piece. But on the other hand, when he entered politics, he became, as I've already said, a very, very much more divisive and aggressive figure, and very much less of a hero. And I think on the whole, people have been pretty good at kind of explaining how Israelis don't think like that. Don't think the same way that everybody who looks at Israel thinks. It's just not, they don't feel about it the same way. They can't feel about it the same way because their situation is different.
Absolutely. Well, let's consider the sort of, I guess, the later politics for which he was perhaps best known more recently. We heard from Daniela Peled, an editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, one of our regular contributors on the station. She was talking to us about this a little earlier today. Let's hear a short extract of what she had to say.
The defining moment for Israelis of Ariel Sharon's career was the disengagement from Gaza in 2005. He made a complete about turn ideologically, it seemed, or one of the greatest supporters of the settlement movement, decided to go against the wishes of his own party, make a hugely controversial decision, and withdraw all the settlers from Gaza in 2005. I was there reporting on it, and I say it was an incredible thing to see. The Israeli army acting with immense efficiency in a few days removed every settler. There was no civil war, as many had warned. Unfortunately, the way it was done, the unilateral way it was done, is one of the reasons why the Gaza faces immense problems today.
Intriguing stuff from Daniela and Brett. It's interesting, isn't it, that change, sort of a volte-face from Ariel Sharon. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, he fairly soon after that fell into this, had suffered a stroke and fell into the coma, which I guess in a sense prevented us from working out what might have happened had he been able to continue that programme of changes, because it was in a way his hardline stance, his popularity with the right, that kind of enabled him to sell this new vision. How different do you think the situation might have been today? I mean, it's very hard to speculate, obviously.
Just polishing my crystal ball, but it's nice to think about what could have happened. I mean, 2005, Danielle is right, it is a, in my memory, a really significant moment in not only Middle East history, but also world history. It was an event that I remember as a young journalist at the time, or relatively young journalist, very, very clearly and very vividly. And it was a moment where perhaps there was this moment where people held their breath and wondered, is this the start of something bigger? And we don't know. We don't know what would have happened. But certainly it also led to some very strong criticism, as we heard there. So whether he had the fortitude to continue with those that program on his own in the face of criticism from his own colleagues, we won't know whether that would have happened. I mean, but imagine if it did. I mean, imagine what we could be looking at in Israel and Gaza today, a very different pace, perhaps, maybe not.
And George, it is interesting, isn't it, to think that you often need these extraordinary changes, these very dynamic shifts in people's attitudes that are rather surprising to affect real change. Do you think that there is enough people, maybe with the kind of personality that Ariel Sharon had, to do a similar thing now? Or is it become increasingly difficult, actually, in the years since he was removed from the front line of politics?
I think it is very difficult. I think he was absolutely characteristic of military people. He was a man of action. When he changed his mind, by golly, he changed it. And he really stuck to his opinion, I mean, which is exactly what the withdrawal from Gaza was about. And of course, in a way, he left, although his work was terminated abruptly by that stroke, he left a scene which we're almost certainly at some point in the future going to see repeated. I can't, and it is impossible to imagine any form of compromise in the Middle East which doesn't involve the movement of some more Israeli settlers. Exactly how many, that's going to be a matter of disputed and negotiated and so on. But in a way, he said to Israel, look, one of the ways in which you're going to have to settle down is some of these people are going to have to move, and this is what it's going to feel like, and it's going to be pretty hard. So he was a kind of, you see it, I'm going to do it, and you're really going to know what it's like. He was that kind of guy. He wanted people to face some realities.
I mean, that's an interesting point, isn't it, Brett, about the sort of the military background. In some ways, do you almost need that more hard-nosed military thinking to be as bold as that? He'd been bold, you know, literally on the battlefields, and he brought that to the political theatre as well.
Very few dynamic characters like that in politics. So many people are fearful of opinion polls, and Australian politicians have later been very guilty of that. But to have someone forge ahead and have the courage of their convictions, it is a very, very military thing. And from our part of the world, where I'm from, we're not used to that. The military isn't a controlling body. It isn't the almighty military that we see over here in the Middle East and indeed Europe. So for us, it's a bit of a foreign concept. But I couldn't name too many modern leaders in the West, certainly, who have that same background, that same military can-do attitude. And you're right, a man who had the courage to go forward and back it up and have a plan to actually instigate it, not only the policy mindset, but the physical mindset of how you do these things. And I can't think of any that would rival him in modern history. I mean, we're only talking about the last decade or so.
But don't let's romanticize it.
I mean, no, absolutely not.
I'm criticizing myself, not you. This can terribly easily go catastrophically wrong. Just look at Turkey.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, the guy in charge there, Erdogan, is not a military man himself now, and hasn't been for a long time. But nevertheless, it's a military culture there, and it can go. You know, that's the style of politician people have, in Turkish political culture, people have been taught to respect, and it's going horribly wrong right now in front of our eyes.
And again in Egypt as well, the military is playing a very big role there.
Even closer to Israel. Better example, perhaps.
It's certainly a delicate balancing act. Before I encourage Brett Mason to once again gaze into his crystal ball of news, which I think is going to be making regular appearances, let's shift our sights somewhat to Iran. It's been announced the nuclear deal between that country and the six major negotiating powers will come into force as planned later this month on the 20th. We sort of chart this course. It's a long and rocky road, and we watch the twists and turns with interest. Particular issues with Iran in terms of whether they were going to be invited to participate in the Syria talks, this sort of thing. This does seem fairly good news. I mean, are we right to be optimistic, or do we still expect, more kinks? I mean, George, how sort of cynical are you about these things? Or do you try and, look on the bright side if possible?
I think there is a bit of looking on the bright side you can do. I think it is possible to look at this deal and say that given the level of mistrust between all the parties and the two main parties, America and Iran, the fact that they agreed anything at all is really quite a remarkable thing in itself. And okay, it took a very long time, but the circumstances were incredibly difficult. It's quite a small deal. It doesn't last for very long. And it's quite limited. But on the other hand, if you're going to kind of build trust between these two kind of enemies, you've got to start somewhere. And if it does mean that dialogues take place, which have never taken place for the past 10 years or longer, start working, then you have to say that small and imperfect though it is, It's done something good. But you've got to say the level of mistrust is incredibly high. And in both countries, that is to say in the American Congress and the Iranian Parliament, there are very large bunches of hardliners who are already working quite publicly and quite hard to make sure that even if the deal doesn't fall apart, the moment it stops, everybody goes back to where they were before.
It's interesting, isn't it, Brett? I mean, not to sort of draw clumsy comparisons between the situation with Sharon, but, it's interesting in Iran you have something of a moderate in Rouhani who does still face this very aggressive resistance from these more sort of hawkish elements, within the parliament. Is it a sustainable position to sort of, come back in from the cold for him politically, at home?
Oh, it's very difficult. And the political background intrigues me about this deal. Obama and Rouhani both needed a win politically, didn't they? They both needed to strike some kind of deal because they're both, at least on the face value, keen to strike a deal. Yet they're facing internally Obama through the Republicans, who have said this is a terrible deal, seeing the relaxing of those sanctions, effectively pumping money into a state that it says sponsors terrorists. You've got a fairly moderate Iranian president who's reaching out to the world, whatever the motive, through Twitter, through social media, politically, opening a dialogue with the president of the United States, which 5 years ago, who would have thought that we would have seen that? So both of those leaders have staked a lot on getting some form of deal. And in politics, a deal's a deal. And I think in this case, this deal is better than no deal at all. But I think you're right. The undermining internally is more interesting than almost the external factors who have a stake in this deal collapsing. Both leaders seem to be being undermined by their own allies to a certain extent. I'm encouraged, though. I'm optimistic. I think that a lot of Iranians that I speak to about this say that there is genuine goodwill, there is a hope and an eagerness to try and see their country being brought back in, even slightly, out of the cold.
Well, that's a positive note on which we'll take a short pause. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, Brett Mason, from whom we're hearing there, and George Brock. We'll still be here when we return, rest assured. We're going to take a look at some media stories that have caught our eye just after this. Stay tuned.
Whether you're in Ankara or Abu Dhabi, start your day with The Globalist. We'll bring you the world in an hour with comment and analysis on the day's news and the business stories that will be shaping your day.
Banking was never one of the biggest problems in Portugal, even during the crisis.
This is over a decade. Does anybody really believe that the agreement that is reached, let's say even if we did it today, is going to stick for a decade? No one believes that.
And don't miss the monologue, our editor's pithy, funny, or just brutally honest takes on the people and places making the headlines for all the right and wrong reasons.
You can be half sold on a deal if you find yourself happy and content to sit and wait in their lobby.
Could a Europe-wide TV service work? What would such a broadcast outfit even look like?
A friendly cab driver or a tasty breakfast is now an unexpected surprise. And when it comes to what happens on board, well, anything short of a derailment is bliss.
That's The Globalist on Monocle 24 every weekday at 6 a.m. London time. The Globalist is brought to you in association with GE.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 20 minutes past the hour in London. Still with me is George Brock, author of Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age, and Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for SBS World News Australia. Let's move to a few media stories, the natural hunting ground of these sorts of gentlemen. We start in France. The emerging scandal over François Hollande has crowded European headlines over the past week. It's rumoured, of course, that Hollande has allegedly been carrying on an affair with the French actress Julie Gayet. The allegations and photos were first published in Closer magazine. In a twist, the French First Lady, Valérie Trierweiler, entered hospital on Friday for rest and some tests. Now, we're not going to get into the sort of muck of the scandal, perhaps regrettably. But what is interesting always in these cases is the sort of media angle, in particular how the French portray the private lives of their leaders compared with, I guess, some of the other sort of Western nations. Brett, when you kind of cast your eye across the scene, if you will, does it strike you, is there a difference? Is there a more deference, a lack of deference, more intrigue? Or is there often more of a kind of sanguine attitude from the French about the sort of misdeeds of their politicians?
A rare moment of Australian sympathy for the French here, believe it or not. People have a very specific opinion of Australians, but remarkably, I think the French and Australians are on a very similar page when it comes to this. And you might laugh, but I'm being very, very serious. We've had three political sex scandals that I can remember in Australia. One of them effectively outed a married minister in a state government who was seen leaving a gay sauna. He resigned from office. A very effective minister who the revelation showed no indiscretion on a political level, a professional level. There was enormous sympathy. There was an outcry at the media, the television news channel, who effectively outed him and ended his career. Another case where a married minister was revealed to be having an affair, the same thing. And our prime minister, or former prime minister, Kevin Rudd, was caught out going to a strip club in New York City, and his opinion polls actually rose as a result. So I think Australians are very similar to the French. We tend to think, if it's a private matter and it's not affecting their professional ability, who cares? Is there a public interest? You can always spin a line to justify splashing photos like this. I think in Mr. Hollande's case, it's different. He's the least popular French president in history. He's facing a tanking economy, a lot of questions about his leadership. So perhaps should he be off on a motorcycle zipping in and out of apartments, or should he be back at the palace budgeting balancing the books? That's the argument that's here at hand. And I think a very different case to perhaps the ones I reference in Australia.
Absolutely. I think that those differences are quite stark. What do you make of it, George? I mean, in terms of the tenor of the coverage, if you will, Closer magazine, obviously a bit of a different agenda from the kind of classic, what we would consider tabloid scoop, perhaps, in this country. Are you surprised? Do you think that most people share the kind of view that Brett's saying there, that this is not actually relevant to, you know, his work in the front line?
Yeah, but let's not forget that 600,000 people bought Closer magazine in 48 hours. So I don't think it's completely uninteresting to the French population. I think,
but is that at the heart of the matter, though, basically? Is this still about circulation? Closer know that this will do,
absolutely,
their numbers will go.
Yes, because I think French culture in this respect is changing. I don't think the French do respect the privacy of politicians quite in the way that they did 20 or 30 years ago. But I think the first law that this illustrates is that if you're going downwards in politics and you make an idiot of yourself, you go further down. That's all. That's the thing that's happening here. It's somehow he's suffering because his image has been dented in this respect from the sheer kind of dumb ordinariness of running around on a scooter. You know, if he was doing it in a Rolls, it wouldn't quite feel the same, or a Citroën or a Porsche or whatever would be the appropriate thing for a French president. But on a scooter, somehow you can just see a lot of French people just wriggling with embarrassment, because mainly because it was a scooter. The fact that it was an affair is neither here nor there.
Not to mention the aide bringing croissants the next morning.
Yeah, and having to bring the croissant as well. I think the body language, he's supposed to be doing a broadcast, I think it's tonight, and I think the body language of that broadcast is going to be pretty fascinating. And, you know, it's really overall not going to help his reputation. The raw truth of the matter is, if you're right at the very top of a political system, it is extremely difficult to argue that you should really have complete privacy. People go on a lot about the privacy law in France, and there is a privacy law, but the fact is that if you use it, you get very small damages. So really, actually, the taboo on talking about the private lives of presidents, it was a convention, not really a law. Actually, I think that convention's now been eroded. You can deplore it or you can say it doesn't matter, but I think basically it's changed, and France is a slightly different country because of digital economics. People are more curious about their leaders. A whole host of cultural things are changing.
There's no doubt that it's changed, but do you think it's going to hurt his figure? I mean, I know they're not good opinion poll figures, and he's certainly not popular by any stretch, but most French people are interested. They'll buy the magazine, they'll have a laugh at the revelations of the shoes and the helmet and the croissants and all those little bits of tittle-tattle, but whether or not it actually affects them, I mean, culturally, they look at these things very differently to perhaps Australians and the Brits. So I don't know whether it will actually do it. I think how he reacts to it, how his character and how he responds to it, that will probably be more telling than what's actually happened. I think that a lot of French people that I've spoken to, journalists in the last sort of 24 hours have said, well, you know, it's not exactly a surprise. I think, as you say in that speech, how he handles it, whether he, I mean, in Australia, perhaps you might get away with making light of it. I don't think he will, but I don't know. I think you'd be surprised about people are interested, but whether or not it changes their voting patterns, I'm not convinced.
But George, just on that broader cultural point you made, I mean, the sort of indiscretions of some of his predecessors at the Élysée Palace have been, if not exactly well documented at the time, largely speculated upon. They often are revealed later. And there was very much, whether it was through reverence or because there were people just didn't consider it relevant. You sort of alluded to it there. You said it was to do with the shifting nature of media, the sort of digital media economy. Is that really the driver for the change in attitudes? And it's not really a social thing uniquely. It is about partly the business of the media and how that works.
I think the fact that on social media and social networks you can spread information of this kind much more quickly than you used to is part of it. But I think to pick another one of it, part of it is all this kind of indulgence and privacy was about male politicians. One of the things that half the French population, who are women, don't think that this applies to French female politicians. There have been a number of occasions, they haven't, of course, been as spectacular and as well publicized as this, where the private lives of female politicians have been under discussion. And lo and behold, French women have discovered that actually the rules for women, they're completely different. Yeah. Everybody discusses it absolutely fine. No question of any kind of discussion, privacy. They'd be horrified if these women used privacy laws and so on. So double standards, they're eroding part of what used to be the privacy that those presidents got.
And that's double standards true. In media and in public life. Whatever next? I can't believe it. Let's move on. I want to talk a little bit more about some other sort of revelations, a slightly different character, the recently published memoirs of the former US Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. In his book, there's various sort of suggestions and allegations talking about Obama and Clinton, suggesting that their opposition to the Iraq War, for example, had been political. Some pretty heavy criticism of Vice President Joe Biden as well. He appeared on the Today Show this morning, Robert Gates, to sort of offer up an explanation. The host, Matt Lauer, asked him if he was surprised by the media attention given to his book. And this is what Robert Gates had to say.
Not really surprised, but, in a way, disappointed that the book has sort of been hijacked by people along the political spectrum to serve their own purposes, taking quotes out of context and so on. And it's sort of part of the political warfare in Washington that I decry in the book.
Well, you say taken out of context. In reading the book, there are a lot of times where you level a very stark criticism at someone, and then a couple of sentences later, or maybe paragraphs later, or pages later, you kind of ease back on and say something of, well, actually, I kind of agreed with that person. But you're a veteran. You served for 8 presidents, actually. You've been in Washington a long time. You know that it's the grenade you throw more than the pullback that's going to make the headlines. You had to know this would happen.
Well, I wasn't.
Robert Gates trying to justify himself there. There's a lot of head shaking going on here. Brett, I mean, it is astonishing naivety if he means it, isn't there? From such a seasoned veteran on Capitol Hill. I mean, Matt Lauer put it pretty well there. He had to know. Why is he even pretending to come out with these explanations?
You write a book about Washington, you launch it in Washington, and then you're suddenly surprised that it's used by Washington, the most political and perhaps vicious city in the world? I think not. I mean, he's a very experienced political operator. He knew exactly what he was doing when he was writing these some might say ill-constructed, but there's nothing ill-constructed about this book. It's been edited and sub-edited and gone through with a fine-tooth comb. He knew exactly what he was doing when he said those things in the book.
Do you think he's can get away with any suggestion that he wasn't expecting the sort of reaction, George, or do you think that's willful? Is he willfully being willfully evasive?
No, this is the spectacle of a man pulling the pin out of a grenade. It goes off, and he says, "Oh, it went bang." I mean, it's just complete hypocrisy. I thought the interviewer had it absolutely right. I mean, I suspect that his memoirs are on the rather heavily edited side. I mean, this is a guy who really knows where an awful lot of the bodies are buried. You know, and as far as I can gather, I haven't read the book, but I mean, I've read about it. As far as I can gather, you know, the number of skeletons that emerge, not enormous.
Absolutely. Maybe Robert Gates shouldn't be so worried after all. I should point out, of course, he's been appearing and he's been wearing this neck brace as a result of a fall at his home. I think there might be a joke about this book and some kind of being a pain in the neck, something like that for him.
I think it was Hillary Clinton that did that too.
Oh, on that note, surely we should leave it there. George Brock and Brett Mason, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here today on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. This is Monaco 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
Yes, you're listening to Midori House. There's plenty to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll be checking in with our man in Copenhagen, heading to Milan for Men's Fashion Week, and get a dose of modern art in Lisbon. Plenty to enjoy. Before we get started on that, though, let's get some world news headlines. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. Syria and Iran were high on the agenda as the French Foreign Minister and the US Secretary of State met in Paris today. John Kerry said Syria's government and some rebels may be willing to permit humanitarian aid to flow, enforce local ceasefires and take other confidence-building measures in the nearly three-year-old civil war. In Thailand, the protest leader Suthep Thaksuban has told thousands of supporters tonight that they will continue their campaign until they win or lose, placing no time limit on the shutdown. Tens of thousands of Thai anti-government protesters have occupied parts of central Bangkok, meeting no resistance from the authorities. In Africa, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has now signed a bill today that criminalises same-sex relationships, defying Western pressure over gay rights and provoking criticism from the United States. The bill contains penalties of up to 14 years in prison and bans gay marriage. And the US Vice President Joe Biden has met with the Israeli President Shimon Peres today after both attended the funeral services for the former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Biden and Peres discussed peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 in London, 16:33 for our listeners in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Copenhagen, where our correspondent there, Michael Booth, joins me now on the line. Michael, great to have you with us on the programme as always. Thank you for joining us. We're starting today with a very serious, sorry story, an abuse scandal that's really gripping the country. Tell us what the sort of response is in the media and more broadly when these kinds of stories emerge in Denmark. Is there a sense of just pure shock that these are perhaps not things that normally happen, you know, within their borders?
Yeah, good evening, Tom. That's exactly it, really. That's the shocking thing. I mean, the case is about a young girl born into an abusive family, raped by her father from the age of three, and then rented out by her father from the age of 11 in a rural community in southern Jutland. These things do unfortunately happen everywhere in the world, but somehow in Denmark it is a bit more shocking because the Danes pride themselves on their high levels of trust and social cohesion and collectivity. So, and they think all the systems are in place to deal with this. But what happened is this poor girl slipped through the system. Many people mentioned her to the authorities. Local authorities came and visited the house several times. But the abuse went on for years and years. And it's front page story in the newspaper this week because she's actually going to be suing her local authority.
And tell me, Michael, I mean, we've seen stories like this, as you say, around the world. Often there's a lot of hand-wringing and occasionally, you know, some pretty decisive action to correct, you know, failures and checks and balances, particularly where local authorities or the departments that handle these kinds of cases have been seen to fail. Is there going to be that kind of demand then for sort of swinging change in Denmark? Or will people be willing to admit that perhaps this was just one error in a system that otherwise actually is of a very good and competent operating standard?
Well, unfortunately, there have been many similar cases that have come to light since because this particular case raised awareness in Denmark and there was such outrage and shock. It first came to light a couple of years ago. So the floodgates kind of opened and then that has led to regulation changes and policy implementation. But the shock is still there and one still wonders whether these things still go on, of course. But yeah, the Danish authorities seem to have moved very quickly to make sure this doesn't happen again. But once the floodgates have opened, there have been many more cases since.
Absolutely. Michael, let's change tack. Well, let's go down a sort of a bit of a cultural road for the next thing you're going to tell us about. We're used to seeing some of the great products out of DR. They're now sold all around the world. Incredible drama. A real sort of cultural export. Yet more successes perhaps on the horizon.
Yeah, you know what? They've done it again. It's really quite amazing. I spend most of my time telling people who come to Denmark or friends abroad, you know, Danish TV is actually pretty rubbish most of the time. It's repeats of Midsummer Murders, Wall to Wall, maybe the odd episode of Taggart if you're lucky. And then VR keeps kind of churning out these really world-class series. Once a year, it always goes out Sunday night at 8 o'clock here in Denmark. And the latest one has just started. And I have to say, you know what? It's the best ever. It is the best one so far. It's called Arvingerne, which means kind of the heirs. When it comes to BBC in the UK later in the year, it's going to be called The Legacy. And it's a family drama which tells about a famous Danish artist, it's fictional, a famous Danish artist, female, elderly, who dies, leaving a very complicated inheritance, four children by three different men. One only comes to light just before she dies. And so the series is progressing now as the four battle over the inheritance of all of her very valuable works of art and her manor house on the island of Thun and so on and so forth. But what's great about it is just the writing is so original. Even the set design, you've never seen anything like it. It's amazing. They've created basically a life's work for this artist. And then beyond that, this Shakespearean story. They're already calling it a classic, the Danish TV reviewers. It got 2 million viewers, almost 2 million viewers on the second episode, up actually from the first episode. So you can look forward to it. It's a blockbuster.
Absolutely. It sounds great. Just briefly on that, Michael, I mean, you mentioned they've done it again. I mean, how are they achieving it? I mean, you said obviously great writing, and that is the key to, you know, all great television ultimately. But is there something else culturally? I mean, what makes it so seemingly easy to keep delivering these hits one after another?
I think they're quite good at betting on the right horse. You know, they nurture writers. They take time. It's all about time. They let the writers take their time to write the series, and they give them at least two series to get it right. I have to say that this all started, this process, I think about 10 years ago when some Denmark's radio producers went to the States, watched how they were making shows over there and came back and took a lot of lessons with them. But if there's one person behind all of this, it's Pia Berndt, who will be familiar to Monocle 24 listeners. We've interviewed her a couple of times. She's the producer behind this show, behind The Killing, I think also behind The Bridge. And she's a quite remarkable woman.
Well, you need a few remarkable characters to make these things happen, don't you, Michael? That's always the secret in the end. Let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about, well, a story I guess some of our listeners will remember, Burberry and some of Burberry's travails when they sort of, what, how would you determine it, the wrong sort of people started wearing their clothing. A similar kind of story in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, exactly. This is why I mentioned it. It did remind me of the whole Chav Burberry thing, where Burberry did everything it could to distance itself from its buyers. Now, we've got a really cool menswear label in Denmark called Woodward, and they have stores in Berlin and Vienna and Moscow and Copenhagen, of course. And the guy behind it, whose name is Carl Oscar Olsen, he's a bit of a controversial figure, a bit of a renegade, and he saw one of his Woodward hats, baseball caps, being worn by a judge on X Factor on Denmark, the Danish TV on Saturday. And he was not happy about this. He felt it didn't really suit the image of his brand, and he tweeted as such. He said, take that hat off, basically. And people in Denmark don't really like that. They don't like people kind of putting people in boxes, making judgments like that, making almost class or social judgments. And there was a bit of an outrage, actually. It's made the newspapers, which seems kind of ridiculous. Seems quite tame, really. But no, they don't like it when people with power abuse other people like that.
Well, how very noble of them. I just wonder, will Mr. Olsen have to make some kind of apology, do you think? Or is it one of these things where actually it may pass by without too much further incident?
No, the judge was a quite well-known pop star, and apparently he made his peace with her the next day.
Oh, so we can all sleep easy in our beds tonight.
Yes, that's good relax, stuff. Everyone.
Thank you very much, Michael. That's Michael Booth, Monocle's man in Copenhagen. Up next, we'll be continuing to talk fashion. We're at Men's Fashion Week in Milan. Stay tuned to find out more on Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of this work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
I am joined now on the line, live from Milan, by Tom Morris, Monocle's design editor, of course. Tom, very good day to you. Tell us, what is the scene that you've discovered for yourself in Milan these last days or two?
Well, it's been a couple of very, very busy days, sort of back-to-back showroom appointments, catwalk shows, Monocle drinks party last night, which made today slightly more difficult than usual. but it's been, yeah, a busy couple of days.
And tell me about the sort of key things that are, what was sort of dominating the discussion as you're talking to, you know, the various people there, the key figures, I guess, throughout the industry. What's the general sense? People very optimistic. What are they getting particularly excited about?
It's a funny one at the moment. I think basically the whole of the sort of menswear Italian in the fashion industry has found itself in a bit of a crux at the moment. You've got, because Pitti, which was last week, has felt itself stunted down by a couple of days with all the men's shows that are going on in London now, which is sort of fairly new thing on the fashion calendar. And then you have Milan,
which has been a great couple of days, but it's followed closely by Paris, which has, over the past couple of years, has become a real, I think, much more important commercially and creatively for the men's industry. So Milan's found itself in a bit of a funny spot. I think people are slightly more sort of wary of what's going on at the moment. But certainly, I mean, there have been some fantastic people that we've seen. I think, you know, Italy, it's still a kind of centre of really amazing tailoring, the great skills that are being used to create these amazing suits and shirts. And I don't think anything will ever rock its crown in that way. But and there have been some great new finds on that front, on the tailoring side.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, tell us a little bit more about that then. I mean, what should we be looking out for? It's interesting, as you say, that those traditional skills, so often the sort of the cornerstones, the founding strength of the business there, is that's still what dominates. Tell us about some of the other marks that you've been talking about then.
I think it's just, you know, it's the amazing menswear tailoring. The couple of people that we've seen, some great new brands. There's one called the Gigi, which you popped it down by Siesta, which has just launched. It's designed by one of the Boglioni family, who left the Boglioni company not so long ago. So it's his new sort of independent venture. And just really amazing attention to detail. You know, a real almost forensic use of these cloths from these incredible mills that are sort of dotted around Italy. Some beautiful jackets there. Went to see Massimo Alba today, who's got some beautiful knits. Drew Moore, who are moving away from their traditional knitwear brand, but sort of going more into trousers, they're doing a collaboration on shirts. They're very interesting. On the more of the higher end scale, Prada's show yesterday was fantastic. Slightly more imaginative than the more of the sort of tailoring stuff we've seen. There were sort of bodices that ballet dancers could be seen wearing, sort of big jackets wrapped up like sort of with bondage straps, some quite sort of 70s tailoring. An amazing show. They had the big brass band playing with Marilyn Manson loudly coming in over the top of it. That was a real piece of theatre to watch, as it always is at Prada. Gucci's Day, some more beautiful coats there, nice dinner jackets. Bottega Veneta yesterday was fantastic. Ferragamo, more kind of really fantastic tailoring. Yeah, I mean, some really good stuff.
And Tom, of course, I'm always rather suspicious when I hear about you travelling all around the world, that really you're just seeking out, you know, all the best parties, all the most fun evenings, cocktail events, that kind of thing. Is it measuring up on that front as well?
Yeah, men's week's always a bit more of a slightly sedate affair compared to women's week when, it's parties a go-go. And I remember doing the shows many years ago, and they'd, every night there would be most magazines, most of the big fashion houses would be putting on events. And, you know, I think the fashion industry is still slightly strapped. There's a few less things on the menu than would normally be. It's, you know, a very serious, sober affair. We're there to work and to pick up new finds. So it's very well behaved. The Monocle Drinks Party last night was fantastic. We had about 120 people, friends, family. That was really good fun. Back to work this morning.
Absolutely. Well, whether it's a sober affair, I don't know. We'll have to be the judges of that. Tom Morris in Milan, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. Yes, you are listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. It's time for some music. Up next, we'll be getting a dose of modern art in Lisbon. I like the sound of that. Let's talk a little Portuguese language in musical terms. From Angola, this is Anselmo Ralph with the song Não Me Tocas. That was Anselmo Ralph with the song Now I'm
podcasts here on Midori House. We're going to get some culture before the end of the programme. It's time for our daily review segment. We go through the very best in books, theatre, art, music and drama with our correspondents and contributors all around the world. Today it is art up for discussion. Santiago Rodriguez-Tarditi is Monocle's Edits editor and America's bureau chief. He's recently been investigating the local art scene in Lisbon. And he joins us now live from New York to give us his thoughts. Hi Santiago, how are you today?
Tom, I'm very well, and you?
I'm not too bad. I must just start by asking you, Santiago, what did you think about Anselmo Ralph and Nao Me Tocas? Did you like that?
I love the beat, yeah, and your pronunciation too was really good.
It's not bad, is it? I gather that it means don't touch me. Do you ever get, you know, you don't ever get told that, do you, Santiago?
Are you half Portuguese or have you been to Angola before?
I speak a little, but I spend some time in Angola now and again.
Well, you got it right, because that's exactly what it means.
Oh, familiar words for you, I'm sure, Santiago. Let's move on. Let's talk about the museum scene in Lisbon. What's the city like? You know, in cultural terms, it's a great place to visit. What about as a sort of an art destination? Would you give it your special recommendation?
Yeah, Lisbon has a strong cultural scene with many museums and galleries dotted across the capital. Surprisingly, there are a lot of trade museums. So you'll hear about the Electricity Museum, the Museum of Tiles, or the Puppet Museum. Some are privately owned and others are run by the government. Last year, I went to an amazing exhibition by Joana Vasconcelos. It took place at the Palacio de Ayuda, which is one of the government's biggest buildings, an architectural salvaged palace that hosted this very, very special exhibit. And although I've been to Lisbon many times, especially recently, last year I went six or seven times, I had never taken the time to visit the Gulbenkian Museum, which I did in December.
And what was that like, Santiago? Because this is mainly about modern art, is that right?
Well, the museum is named after Kaluste Sarkis Gulbenkian. He was an Armenian businessman who was involved in the signing of the biggest oil contracts of the early 20th century, including the merger that gave birth to the Shell Company, of which he, of course, took a big cut. He was also a philanthropist. And he collected a lot of art, furniture, decorations, sculptures from around the world since a very young age. He has a great collection of Roman, Greek, Ottoman, Chinese objects that he bought from different dealerships all over the world. He traveled a lot from Europe to Asia to Latin America, and he would always bring back something to his collection. After many years of living in Paris, he left the city in 1942 and he moved to Lisbon, where he lived until his death in 1955. After he passed away, he donated his collection, part of his fortune, to fund this foundation that not only houses the museum that showcases his personal collection, but also the CAM, the Modern Art Center.
Oh, I see, because I was going to ask you, I mean, it sounds like his collection is very diverse. It's often quite hard to curate that, but I guess there's this new modern art museum as well as his original pieces. What about the Modern Art Museum? Does it sort of stand up next to some of the other great contemporary art spaces in the big sort of European capitals? What did you make of it?
It's very well curated, mostly Portuguese artists. It's rather small, but it's in a beautiful building that it's also part of the foundation. And in this last month that I went and visited, there was a temporary show by the Finnish artist Raija Malka, entitled Gymnasium, in which she explored the shapes and the textures of sports arenas and stadiums, and her main topic started the debate about how exercise builds not only the body but also the mind.
Well, that sounds like a noble ambition. Just very briefly, Santiago, would that be the sort of the highlight from your most recent trip, or was there actually some of the older objects in the Gulbenkian collection that actually you found maybe more impressive?
Well, one of my favorite pieces of the Gulbenkian personal collection was a marble statue of Diana, the hunting goddess, that previously belonged to Catherine of Russia, and he purchased from the Hermitage Museum. But I also I liked a big rubber ball that stood at the entrance of the Modern Art Center, also by Raja Malka. Unfortunately, it wasn't for sale. Otherwise, I think it would have looked very well here in the Monocle office in New York.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure, given the people who are monitoring your expenses account, they're probably glad that it wasn't for sale, Santiago. Santiago Rodriguez-Tarditi, our America's Bureau Chief in New York, thanks very much for joining us on the programme. Now, that's all we have time for on today's show. My thanks in particular to my special guests, George Brock and Brett Mason. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rowena Wiles, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Rob Bound will have Culture up next for you. He'll be talking to Gregory Porter, amongst other highlights. 2200, the Monocle Daily, of course. This show will be back at the very same time tomorrow. Tyler Brulé will be in the chair for that one. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Have a great day.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph. The watch made to break barriers. The watch dedicated to endurance. The watch that was born to race. Rolex.